Rugby League European Federation podcast. I hope you're all keeping as well as possible. This week's guest is a coach this time, Steve McCormack, who coached Scotland from 2004 up into 2017. Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Graham. How are you?
I'm very well in Edinburgh. Whereabouts are you, Steve, at the moment?
Centre of the universe at the moment, Graham, at Wigan. Yeah, I'm in the middle of Wigan at the moment, so all good.
Fantastic, Steve. Listen, before we get into your coaching career with Scotland, I always ask everybody, what's your first memory of rugby league?
I think all good memories, really. I mean, my dad played for Wigan and Oldham in the late 50s and 60s, and I think living in Wigan, you didn't have a choice, really, with regards to the sport. And you know, I were really fortunate to watch the great Wigan teams. You know, when there was the Invincibles, really, it was a fantastic time. You know, I like the football as well. You know, the Wigan football. So quite sporty as a youngster, but great memories watching the great Wigan sides with Andy Gregory and Ellery Hanley. And my first memory was probably when I was 10 and Wigan played a tour in Queensland side. I think it was 1981, 82, and that was my first time watching the game, and ever since then I was stuck with it.
Okay, so some big names in that Queensland team?
There was, I can't remember it, to be honest. I remember some of the Wigan sides, but there would have been, and, you know, looking at that Queensland team and then looking at the Kangaroos that came over in the 80s and the 90s and going to all those games, and, you know, good childhood, really. I remember my dad taking me to every single game, you know, every single international game, every single Wigan game, home and away. I remember going on the 1992 Ashes tour to Australia, watching that, and we was in Melbourne when Great Britain had a great victory, and yeah, some real good memories, and you know, I've been hooked on the game ever since.
Yeah, so you did have a playing career, but it was cut short, wasn't it, by injury? Am I right?
It was, yeah. My career was cut short at 19, so you know, I was lucky enough to, you know, to play a couple of international games as well in England schools, representative, and all going well. I was at Wigan for a couple of years, and then I got a shoulder injury and never really recovered from that. I'd had quite a few operations, and still having the operations now at the moment, and yeah, it was pretty sad, but I was really fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to start coaching again, which I'll always be thankful of.
So you meant you moved into coaching pretty early, and I think we first met through the days of the World Class Programme led by David Waite, and I can remember doing filming at Oral with a big cherry picker, you know, so we could get the filming angles. Ray Unsworth.
I do remember it well.
And David, so, you know, those guys were ahead of their time, because nowadays we've got drones and you can just put a drone up and film it rather than have to get a full cherry picker in and such like. But those were good days in that programme, weren't it?
They were brilliant days. I remember that day as well, or a couple of days at Oral. You know, it was boiling hot, and I remember some of the players, you know, what got involved in that session. But they were really good, and I've got a lot to thank David Waite for as well. You know, that Excel programme was really good for me. It gave me the opportunity to be part of that program, and it did a good job. David put a lot of good systems in place when he was involved with the British game, and again, I'll always be thankful for him giving me the opportunity that he did do.
Well, of course, that opportunity was to be the coach of Scotland, and you see, you know, he put a system in place, and for 13, 14 seasons, you led Scotland. So just tell us about how you sort of got the call to say, you know, would you want to coach Scotland?
Yeah, it was probably out of the blue, really, that, Graham. I remember doing some regional camps, which we used to have the best youngsters going to places like Rossall and in Blackpool, and there were week-long sessions, and David ran all that and brought all that into the British game, and I remember coaching on quite a few of those and leading on quite a few of those, and obviously, you know, I must have done something okay, and David noticed that, and you know, it was my time when I was at Salford as well. So when I was at Salford Reds, I was quite young then, and you know, it was a little bit of a tough time coaching wise, and he was a bit of a mentor to me, David. I'd ring him up and ask for advice, and you know, when I went to Whitehaven as well, you know, I was still doing these regional camps and national camps, And, you know, he rang me. I remember I was in the office at Whitehaven, and offering me the opportunity, and, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, apologies, folks, for the barking in the background, but a delivery here at home. So, so it's just, of course, just to give people context, in those days, the Scotland and Ireland Wales teams was pretty much run from what was Red Hall, the RFL, because I was part of that sort of the logistics side of things. But of course, over time, it all got devolved much more. So obviously, one of the first things you did, I think it was the 2004 European Championship. So just give a who else was on the staff at that time, Steve? Who was working with you?
Yeah, it was a real good staff. Dave Rotherham, who's now, you know, high up in the RFL and doing a fantastic job. He was my assistant, my first assistant for that year, and we got on really well. You know, very knowledgeable coach and a very honest bloke as well. You know, somebody who I could rely on. I think it was at St Helens at the time. We had Richard Thewlis, who's the current CEO at Huddersfield. Again, great manager, great organiser. And we had, I remember Jason Davidson was the conditioner at that time. Again, highly experienced, you know, won things, been with a great Leeds team, and was absolutely bonkers as well, which helped some of the things that he did and brought the team together. You know, I remember, you know, things like, you know, the Bush Tucker trials and some of the challenges he got. You know, it wasn't all about doing things right on the pitch. It was getting the staff right off the pitch and, you know, making sure it was an enjoyable environment and a challenging environment. And you know, the initial staff who we had that year was, you know, was amazing, really.
Okay. And just, do you remember your first game as coach?
Vaguely. It's that long ago now. I don't. I honestly don't, Graham. We had that many games and you know, that many challenges. You know, the early days were, you know, very challenging with regards to getting the squads together. Yeah. But again, I don't really remember my first game.
Okay. Just give a bit of insight when you say about challenging, you know, because getting the squads together. So, you know, there's been the Super League, there's been the National, you know, whatever. I think in those days it was maybe the Ford Premiership or whatever it was called, you know, the semi-professional level. And they've all had those long seasons of players and you get to October. Just give a little bit of insight how some of the sort of negotiations and challenges you had to overcome to get your squad together.
Yeah, it was tough. And it always has been tough, to be honest, because you're relying on a bunch of individuals and a bunch of players that have had long seasons and playing for the respective clubs. And, you know, in November, October, November time, you know, that's the time when, you know, we can go away with our families and the players can go away with their families as well and the partners. And, you know, we had to sell it to them that representing Scotland and having the opportunity to play in the Euro Nations and playing the World Cups was something that they wanted to aspire to do and be really proud of doing. So those challenges were really tough. But to be fair, we got a core of real good individuals early on. You know, I remember people like Andrew Henderson, Ben Fisher, Danny Brough was great. You know, Jason Roach was in there. There was a lot of players, and I think the key to it was they weren't all classed as superstars. You know, we had a lot of diversity with regards to players playing in Super League, players playing in what is the Championship and League One now, and playing in the domestic game. And we just made sure it was a really good environment, and you know, that everybody was proud and privileged to put that jersey on. And luckily, that continued over the 14 years.
Yeah. So you know, just to get that environment, you know, to people wanted to be part of it. And, you know, let's be frank, nobody here was being paid great, you know, match fees. And probably for some of the players, it probably cost them money. Those who were, you know, doing a semi-professional career along with probably, you know, their own full-time career. So just give an idea as to what the kind of things bring them into camp you would set up and do to make sure it was somewhere that they wanted to be.
Yeah, I think initially before we actually got into camp, there was a lot of work done on the actual recruitment. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that the players wanted to play for Scotland and why they wanted to play. and vice versa as well. They wanted to know, you know, a bit about the coaching staff. And, you know, it was things like, you know, the first day in camp or the first couple of days in camp, we'd actually go to travel around the, you know, Scotland and the country, looking at where the, you know, the parents were from, or where they was born, or where the grandparents was from, just so they could get a feel and get an understanding of why they're representing Scotland. And that was brilliant. You know, it was emotional, it was funny. You know, it was, you know, we'd get the players to talk about why they were representing it. We'd get the families involved in it. We'd get the children involved in it. And that's something, you know, irrelevant of the actual tactical and technical side of the game. You know, it was just making sure that we got the right people in there. You know, we just didn't invite anybody into camp. They had to be really passionate and, you know, really enthusiastic about representing not only the country, but the families as well. And it worked well for us. And I think we built on that year after year, you know, whether that be in the big tournaments or, you know, i.e. the World Cup or the other tournaments in between that. And, you know, up until my last day, you know, in Cairns, 2017 World Cup, we did exactly the same thing, where we was really proud of representing everybody that went before us.
It's interesting. So an interesting point for any coach who's going to find themselves coaching a rep team and they've got short periods. So even maybe with only 3 days lead in to your first match up in Scotland, you'd still take the first day or two and do that rather than spend hours and hours in the training field, because you believe that would actually have a more positive impact to people's longevity of loyalty, but also even impact on the pitch.
Yeah, that was the way we decided to do it. You know, there's probably no right or wrong with that, but it worked for us. And, you know, they could all play, they could all catch and pass and, you know, and tackle and do all the technical stuff else. They wouldn't even have been selected in the first place, but we just felt as though that identity and those values that we wanted to put in as a team was really, really important. And that's something we did, you know, from year one to year 14 while I was in charge.
Yeah, sure. So you got a couple of years underneath your belt playing the European champs, and then in 2006-07 we got into the, you know, the World Cup stages, qualifying, you know, heading towards hopefully the 2008 World Cup. And it was a two-legged affair versus Wales, wasn't it? Away in the first year in 2006, and then at home in 2007 with an aggregate score. So, you know, Wales had a pretty good lineup. You know, they had Lee Breers, they had Euston Harris. I think Martin Hall was the coach. So that was obviously a real big first test for you, wasn't it? You know, trying to get Scotland to the World Cup.
Yeah, well, nobody expected us to do that. I think if you look at both sides, and, you know, you mentioned two players there and a coach that vastly experienced, you know, Lee Breers and Euston Harris was the halfback pairing of Wales. And if you look at their side, there's no way we should have got anywhere near them, you know, certainly over both games. But we prepared really, really well. You know, we got a team together. And again, no superstars in that team. They was all hardworking, honest individuals who really wanted to get to that World Cup and wanted to represent Scotland. And those two games, I remember, and I know you was involved in those as well in an official capacity, Graham, but the build-up to it, the actual games, you know, the second game was had a little bit of everything, you know, to in and fro in, and, you know, Wales scored a couple of tries and we was behind, but we knew we was in front aggregate-wise. And just remember Jamie Benn, I think it was, who scored the try, which probably got us to the World Cup. And, you know, to actually, you know, get there and see the rewards that everybody, you know, got through all the hard work was unbelievable. They were good times and two outstanding games.
Yeah, I mean, the first leg, you know, winning away 21-14 in Wales, and then, you know, losing 18-16 at home. But as you say, it was an aggregate thing. So it was about, you know, not looking at that scoreboard just on the day, but looking at the aggregate. So, yeah, I think pretty nerve-wracking for everybody there. But, you know, to know that you're taking a, you know, you become an international coach and then you're off to the World Cup, that must have been a fantastic feeling in terms of achievement.
That was unbelievable, you know, going to the World Cup in 2008. And we decided to, you know, stick with the squad that got us there. You know, there was a couple that didn't get selected because they weren't playing in 2008, 2008. But we stuck with the virtually the same squad that actually got us there. And, you know, we went over there and we stayed in Sydney for the first week. And, you know, I remember the squad flying out to Canberra, you know, to prepare for the French game. And Bruffy and myself had to stay in Sydney for the, you know, for the press conference. And then we both flew separately over to Canberra, and we had to have an emergency landing, landing flying into Canberra, and the mask came down and everything. And, you know, after the Canberra game, we had to, you know, get back to Sydney, and there was no way we was getting on a plane. You know, we actually drove, you know, we actually got on a coach and drove, I think it was 4 or 5 hours to Sydney. But the experience and, you know, the games we played over there and, you know, the camaraderie and the connections we made was something really special.
And just on that, so obviously in World Cups come around, you know, players, maybe higher profile, whether it be in NRL or Super League, sort of then put their hand up for the big event. How conscious were you of staying loyal to those that had got you there and would be there in 2009 and 2010, most probably, compared to bringing in a name who hadn't done anything before but could add to the squad quality? What sort of dilemmas did that present you with?
I think that's probably the toughest part of the job. Really tough because, you know, the hard yards in between the World Cups, you know, we're based in Inverclyde, which is a fantastic venue up in Scotland, and you know they're working hard. And then when we get to the actual, you know, World Cups, where the high profile games are and on TV and in you know, in Sydney and you know everywhere, it's really tough. And we decided to do that in 2008, and it worked for us. We actually built another squad then for 2013 and 2017. But the hard facts as well are that it's a performance environment, and you know we needed to get a better squad to compete. You know the games were getting tougher, the opposition were world class, so it was really, really tough. And there's a lot of players who were really loyal to Scotland and did miss out on the big tournaments as well, and they were tough decisions, but they were decisions done for the right reason. And you know, there were some tough phone calls, but I think predominantly we did reward the majority of players that you know that stuck with us.
And of course, the results. I think beating Fiji, losing to France, ultimately a sort of dead rubber against Tonga, you know, at the end. But you know, all those matches, you know, really good affairs. And also, I think maybe some unexpected wins. Or an expected win for you in terms of the two administrators who gave you the French tickets to fly up to was it Rockhampton, I think?
It was, yeah. We got beat by France at Canberra. It was disappointing that we should have beat France. And then we went to Blue Tongue Stadium in Gosford, which is, you know, an iconic ground, fantastic. And you know, Fiji, who ended up getting through to the semi-final that year, had, you know, Jared Hayne playing for him, Ashton Sims. You know, a lot of NRL superstars, and again, nobody gave us a chance, and we were fantastic that day. You know, we're really, really good. You know, the players would run through a brick wall for each other, and we won it. And then the day after, we it was like a another game after you know, not the semi-finals or the quarter-finals. The losing team within the group had another game, and when we got to the airport, we got all the French tickets. They printed all the French tickets out prior to our game because they didn't expect us to win. So I remember some of our players, you know, dressing up as, you know, they had the berets on and the, you know, just getting some photos, all in good fun.
Sure.
And then we went to Rockhampton, and that what a great experience. We took a beating against Tonga. You know, it was 80-90 degree heat. You know, really humid. But the atmosphere was unbelievable. You know, they couldn't get enough people in the stadium, and to see another part of Australia and to you know, to experience that as well was fantastic.
And you know, you talked there about some of the people playing for Fiji. You know, Ashton Sims, Jared Hayne. So yet again, you took this group of players who on paper, you know, weren't going to be beating Fiji, but they delivered. You know, just give us a bit of flavour, some of the real lieutenants you had in there that were making that happen, you know, and the fact was the team wanted to, would do anything to for Scotland to help them win.
Yeah, when I look back, I think that's been the big strength. I look at, players like John Duffy, you know, he's coaching at Lee now. Outstanding player, you know, outstanding player, an outstanding person. And, you know, the Henderson brothers, I remember Andrew Henderson, you know, stalwart every single year. Ian Henderson played, you know, he had an almighty bust up and a brawl. I think it was with Jared Hayne in the probably first half. And then the winning try, I think it was Oliver Wilkes, who was, again, he was playing for me at Widnes at the time. And Oliver, again, was, you know, hard as nails and, you know, represented, you know, the country with absolutely everything. And, you know, they would run through a brick wall for each other. And I think that that game, you know, John Steele, I remember John Steele scoring as well, you know, dual international, was really good for us. Ian Morrison, you know, just hard-working, tough, tough men. And when you put some skill in there as well with the people like Danny Brough and John Duffy and the Henderson brothers and Michael Robertson played, you know, he'd just come off the back of a grand final playing for Manly. So we had a good mix of grit and determination and, you know, a sprinkling of quality in there, and it was a great occasion.
And just on that, obviously going back a little bit to when you started, obviously the connection with the game in Scotland, as you say, you know, you're playing in a professional level. You had young Paddy Cooper with you at the 2008 World Cup, who in effect was a domestic player. But one of the things that always stood out for me, Steve, was I think in those early years, I think it was a young lad called Ross Marshall who you brought into the European Championship squad. He was only about 18, 19, I think, at the time. And you didn't feel confident enough to play him at that level, but you wanted to give him that exposure to it, you know, the environment. But then I remember seeing you 2 months later come to watch him play Scottish students, I think, versus Queensland students up in Edinburgh on a cold December day. But because you'd given that pledge to him that, you know, you would come and watch him because he hadn't had a chance to show in the European Champs. So you obviously began to work at trying to gain credibility and relationship building with the domestic game in Scotland as well. Did you see that as quite important?
It was crucial, absolutely crucial. And I remember some what we used to class them as domestic quarter. I think we used to have five in the European Championships. And I remember Ross really, really well. And he came into camp and, you know, really daunting for the domestic players who were playing up in Scotland at that time, because, you know, the standard wasn't brilliant up there. They didn't have many teams, didn't have many games. And then, you know, 1 week they're on a, you know, in a park training with three or four lads, other lads and coaches. And the week after the training with Danny Brough, and he's putting bombs up to him, and, you know, Ian Henderson and superstars of our game. And I remember Ross really well. He was actually on the bench. We put him on the bench for one of the games, and he never got on it. I just wasn't. It was nip and tuck. It was a brutal game, and I didn't think he was quite ready for that. And he'll probably admit that himself, Ross. You know, but his family had been there, and his family had watched it. They were really proud that he'd been selected in that squad. But as you said, I went up a few weeks later just to watch him and, you know, I discussed it that I wanted to see him. I was really happy with his commitment and, you know, for his development, it would be good going forward, and, you know, made the trip up to Scotland and very glad I did.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, having seen different coaches that go about it across Ireland and Wales, that just that simple act of going up, you know, turned the words of "I want to see you develop" actually into a real meaning. So it, you know, and I, you know, having been on the Scotland Rugby League board for a couple of years, worked with you about trying to raise the standard, you know, to make sure that domestic quota players came through that were going to be good enough. And I suppose, you know, one of the great success stories that you've been part of is David Scott, of course, you know, who emerged from Scotland and then obviously went on to a really good career down south. So that must have been great to see someone like that come through.
Yeah, brilliant. You know, I wish there was a lot more like David. You mentioned Paddy. Paddy was good. You know, Paddy, you know, played at the level, and I think he went playing pro at Workington as well. But David's a great example of what can happen. You know, he's played at every level for Scotland, and then came down. I think he started at Hull KR in the reserves and was real good there. And he's had a really good Championship career. I think he's currently maybe at Batley at the moment, or Sheffield. But just fantastic off the field, very very articulate, represented us really well with the media. You know, his mum and dad came to every game and every session, and whether that be in France or Australia or in Edinburgh, And he's a great example, David, and he'll play in this year's World Cup, I should imagine. You know, he's been in every camp and every tournament for me, and I can't speak highly enough of him.
Yeah, no, it's you know, he came from taking his opportunity, and now I think it certainly was one of the first names on the team sheet, probably in your latter days and certainly the last few years, and is a really great role model and for others to follow. So going into the 2013 World Cup, obviously that was going to be in England, and a tough draw again. You know, you got the back to playing Tonga and obviously Italy, and then of course the USA. So that was going to be a tough group to get out of. But that's when sort of the love affair with Workington developed, didn't it, for Scotland?
Yeah, Workington was brilliant for us and the whole of West Cumbria, and you know, we made it a little bit of a home from home. And the build up to that World Cup, you know, looking at that draw again, everybody wrote us off. You know, nobody expected us to even win a game, never mind get out of the group and get to the quarterfinals. And you know, I remember the build up to that, and you know, we had a good settled squad. We just needed some additions. And you know, I remember speaking to a couple of NRL players as well, and you know, we actually brought Peter Wallace over from Penrith, and I would go probably to say that he's probably one of the best players that's ever played for Scotland, Peter. Him along with Danny Brough and you know, Ian Henderson and all the others. We had a really, really good squad, and leading up into that tournament, I was really confident that it would take a good side to beat us. You know, and I knew the Workington and the Cumbria public could get behind us, and it would be a packed stadium at Derwent Park. And you know, I really fancied us in the build-up, and you know, there were floods prior to that game against Tonga. It was, the weather conditions were awful, and it just set it up nicely for us. And you know, I actually watched the game last week. It was on again during the lockdown on one of the social media channels, and what a fantastic game that was. And you know, you look at that Tongan team with all the superstars in it. And you know, it was nip and tuck all the way, and people like Matty Russell, Ben Fisher, you know, Peter Wallace, Brett Carter. It was absolutely sensational, and that's probably one game that I'll never forget.
So just going back to when you recruited Peter Wallace, high profile NRL. So what's the kind of diligence you did to make sure he was also not just known he was a good player, but the right type of person? And, you know, particularly he's over on the other side of the world. How did you go about that, Steve? Because you talked very passionately about finding the right type of people to bring in.
Yeah, well, fortunate enough, from 2008, we networked quite well. Dave Rotherham was really good at that and still is at networking, probably a lot better than I was at the time. And, you know, we had a lot of people that we met when we was over there, and those relationships stayed, you know, over the... And still do, really, over the last couple of years. And you know, did a lot of we actually found out that Peter was eligible. You know, you get a list through of every single player, you know, playing everywhere in every league who's eligible. So I did some digging on with the staff. I know all the Penrith staff, and spoke to Peter an awful lot as well regarding, you know, possibility of him coming over. And I think to get him over just made a massive difference. I remember the first session he came to, you know, we picked him up from the airport. The squad had already been in a couple of days. And the first session was on an all-weather pitch at the back of Whitehaven Rugby League Club. And you could just see the quality he had straight away. It was like he'd been within the squad for years. And the impact both on and off the field that Peter made was sensational, to be fair.
So you beat Tonga, as you say, in a real ding-dong affair in terms of the scoreline. And then obviously there was a similar sort of match with Italy, which was a draw. And I can remember I was living in Manchester at the time, couldn't get up to Workington then, but, you know, listening to it on the radio, you know, and Dave Woods, I think, and it was all fairly dramatic and so on. Of course, then you had to beat the USA at Salford, which was done. But did you have to wait for other results to come in to know? Was that the...
Yeah, we did. We had to we beat USA, as you said, at Salford, and we're staying. I think the Premier Inn in the middle of Manchester, and we actually watched Tonga and it might have been Italy or someone else, and we all watched it as a squad. And if the results went our way, we'd be going to Headingley for the quarter final against the Kiwis, and if it didn't go our way, then we was all going home the day after. So it was a bit of a party either way. You know, we just all stayed there as a group, and I think there's some clips on YouTube or whatever when we actually found out we was winning. And
yeah, I think social media was in full flow then, and there was some, and obviously any celebration was quickly followed by a rousing rendition of "Flower of Scotland."
It was, yeah, it was a great party after it. I remember going doing some media stuff for the BBC or whatever, and when I came back, the WWE wrestlers had been at the MAN, so people like Big Show and John Cena and everything was in our hotel, and when I went in, it was late on, about 1:30 in the morning I got back, and they started singing "Flower of Scotland," so that was a bit surreal. I never thought, you know, the WWE wrestlers would be singing the "Flower of Scotland," but you know, a unique time. It's something I'll not forget.
Any truth and rumours that Danny Brough said he'd become, take him on for a bout in the foyer?
It wouldn't surprise me. It definitely wouldn't surprise me with Brough, and he'd probably win. He'd probably win as well.
So obviously, you know, you're then going to face New Zealand, which in many ways is the first time that you're going to face one of the big three, as it were, and obviously New Zealand with the reigning champions and Headingley and all that means in rugby league. That again, from your coaching journey, must have been a real high point and a moment of, you know, this is a moment to have, of arrival here.
Yeah, that was really special, Graham. That I think for everybody in the squad. I remember doing the captain's run the day before the game, and even Headingley being empty was it's just an iconic stadium. Wonderful players and teams have played there, and it was a bit surreal, really. We did the captain's run, you know, we had some photographs, team photographs, and you know, we had a little bit of tour around, and you know, we was aware that we had a big game the day after, you know, quarter final of a World Cup. But we made sure we enjoyed it as well. You know, you never really get the opportunity to do that. You know, very, very lucky as a coach and as players to do that. And everybody worked exceptionally hard. And, you know, to play in that game, I remember staying in, you know, in the Worsley Hotel and getting a police escort to the ground, and, you know, the atmosphere and Sonny Bill Williams playing and the video leading up to it. And, really good days and a privilege to be part of.
Yeah, a real high point that, for in terms of Scotland Rugby League, you know, playing at Headingley against the reigning world champions. And of course, sometimes after World Cup, the year after is difficult, you know, because there's been a lot of effort put in, and you know, the season's longer, you know, so that, you know, the club season's been the same, but obviously the international season extended. But there was a lot on the line in 2014 European Championships, because that was the qualifier for the 26, what was then the Four Nations, which was Australia, England, New Zealand, and the winner of the European Championship. So you had to, presumably you had thoughts about keeping the squad together as much as possible to try and have a good crack at winning the European champs in 2014.
Yeah, we discussed that as a squad, because generally the year after the World Cup, you know, as I said, a lot of the players have sacrificed an awful lot, whether that be having operations after the season, or, you know, weddings and holidays, and you know, the year after, it's normally a little bit of we look to develop some of our domestic players, and we still did that, but we made a conscious effort to get the squad together, keep the squad together, and have a good crack at the European Cup, because again, you don't get many chances to play in the Four Nations, and you know, the carrot at the end of that tournament was something unbelievable. So fair play to everybody, we stuck together, and again, we had a good tournament.
So you opened with wins against Wales and Ireland, set up a home match against France, Gala Shields, and France were still on the running at this time. So this was on a Friday night. So the first hurdle was to win the French game, but it kind of went wrong, down at half-time by a fair old score. And at that moment, the European Championship title in the Four Nations was disappearing over the horizon. So give us an idea of what went on in that dressing room at half-time.
Oh, well, first half we were rubbish. Was, you know, France were fantastic, you know, and they're always liable to do that with the team they've got. But we were rubbish, and I remember being in the halftime dressing room, and it was silent. But I also remember the French players coming past, and a lot of things were being shouted in our dressing room by a lot of people. So they probably did my halftime talk for me. you know, I was embarrassed. The players were embarrassed of the first half performance. And so we went back to, you know, to our values and, you know, what we expected of each other as a group. And the second half was totally different. You know, we actually lost the game, but, you know, the tries we got, you know, the Walker brothers were great. I remember them scoring. You know, I remember Danny Addy being outstanding that game. But yeah, it was a tough half-time team talk, that one, but fair play that the players responded at the end of it.
And therefore, you know, another coaching tip there, because coaching international team, you get the players so little of the time, but, you know, you're at this point, you're 10 years with them, and some of those players maybe 6-7 years. So that bond, that trust that you built up on and off the field, did that play a role that you could trust the players to almost lead that halftime and then go back to values again, not to talk about tactical and technical, but to go back to values? Do you feel that was a sort of culmination of working with players year in, year out, even for only a month at a time?
I think so. I'd like to think so. I mean, we'd done that before as well. I remember there was a time in Ireland, it was a couple of years before that as well, and we were down a massive score at halftime. You know, it might be 30 points, and we came back and won that game. So there was quite a few players still in that dressing room who played in that game. And I think not only, you know, me trusting the players, I think the players trusted each other. And, you know, we just got back to, you know, wanting to be tough and, you know, putting our bodies on the line and not taking no shortcuts. And we felt the first half, well, we definitely first half, we did that and just sat back and let France play. And if you do that, you know, France are fantastic with the individuals they've got. Second half was totally different. You know, we dug in, we had a lot of resilience, we showed a lot of class, we changed the way we played a little bit. I remember just changing the pattern of play a little bit. And it worked for us, thankfully. And, you know, it just set us up for a nerve-wracking few days listening to the France Ireland game.
So it only just struck me looking back was, you know, one of the big ones qualifying for 2008, the actual game that you did it through was lost. And actually, you know, to Wales in 2007, and the game to France was lost, but the aggregates, sorry, the points differential with France was still on the positive for Scotland to be top of the table. But you then had to wait 2 days, didn't you, for Ireland versus Wales, and Ireland had the chance to overhaul you in points difference. So where were you, Steve, for that 80 minutes? You know, where did you position yourself? You know, did you go away and, you know, someone text me at the end of it, or did you try and get updates?
I listened to every second of it, Graeme. I wish they hadn't. I remember being at home, just locked in where I am now, actually in the conservatory, and I just listened to every second because the thought of playing in the Four Nations was unbelievable. And I just remember with it being points difference that I remember France got a breakaway try at Gala Shields in that game what we were sporting about. And I can't remember who chased him back, but he chased him back and they didn't score under the sticks. They were never going to stop the try, but they didn't score under the sticks. And I think that one effort just epitomises everything about what we're all about. And ultimately that took us to the Four Nations.
Yeah, and it was, on points difference. And you say there, you know, again, that simple act of just making sure that the conversion is more difficult possibly got you into what was the 2016 Four Nations, which was Australia you were going to face, facing England and facing New Zealand. I mean, it doesn't really, from a coaching point of view, get any bigger than that, does it?
No, I had to probably pinch myself as well, really. You know, I remember going to the press conference and I was sat next to Wayne Bennett and David Kidwell, Mal Meninga. So they were probably, you know, Mal Meninga was one of my heroes growing up, and you know, Wayne Bennett had done an awful lot, and we were sat at the press conference at Anfield. But we'd also got there on merit. You know, we didn't want to be overawed by it. I didn't want to be overawed by it. You know, everybody worked exceptionally hard, Dave Rotherham and myself, and it was a good moment, and it was a really enjoyable tournament.
So it's interesting because, you know, we could check the archive, but there's a chance that Meninga might have been in that Queensland team that played Wigan at your first ever game that you can remember, you know, and now all of a sudden there, you now sat beside him and obviously Wayne Bennett. So just give, you know, it's interesting your mindset that, you know, obviously these are people you look up to, but at the same time, it's your team and you're one of four nations here. So going into something like a press conference there, did you think about how you're going to behave? So how you come across and how Scotland comes across? Do you have to give that some thought? Because it's really interesting people to be with.
I didn't really think about how to behave. I was just myself, really. I remember when I first got there, I always get there early. I'm just obsessed with getting places early. And Mal came in, and he just came straight away over, introduced himself, and we had a coffee, and you know, it was just great, you know. But you know, I wanted to win. You know, I wanted my team to win. That was all on my mind. And again, people say you've got no chance. You're going to get absolutely battered in all three games. You should, you know, you'd be thinking you didn't want to win that European Championship because you're going to be exposed to, you know, three world class teams. I was totally the opposite. You know, I wanted to beat Australia. I wanted to beat New Zealand and England. And you know, even though you know they're iconic names in the game, you know, Mal Meninga and David Kidwell and Wayne Bennett, all I wanted to do was, you know, was to beat them. And people say I must be mad, but and I believe we could. I honestly believe we could beat Australia. We didn't do, you know, we could beat England. You know, we could beat New Zealand. But I was just myself. I made sure I enjoyed it as well, Graham. That was the key. I think when you get a little bit older and a little bit more experienced, you tend to, you know, step back and just look at things, you know, a little bit more. And you know, probably been guilty of not doing that enough in my career.
And how much did you take that forward, that attitude, into the players? You know, because again, in some ways, they're stepping out onto a pitch and against some of the biggest names. You know, some of these guys, you know, you'll play big names in Super League, but you know, to face the very best of Australia, New Zealand, England is a big occasion. So what kind of mindsets did you try to put in the players for that occasion?
Just exactly the same as what got us to the tournament previously. You know, the first game, we played Australia at Hull KR, and you know, I was looking at their team sheet, and you know, wow, what a team they had. They didn't rest anybody. You know, Cameron Smith played in there, Cooper Cronk played in there, and I'm looking at them, you know, thinking let's have a good crack at them, let's really go. And then the first 20 minutes of that game, they absolutely butchered us. You know, we never got the ball. They was absolutely fantastic. And then second half, we rallied and had a couple of good tries. You know, Ryan Brayley scored, and I think it was Adam Walker scored, and we came out of that game with a lot of confidence, to be fair. But the Australian team that day and that tournament was as good as I've seen for a long, long time.
Sure. And of course, your next game is, for every Scotsperson, is the ultimate. Scotland versus England, the first time at the full level. Obviously also down the Rioch Arena in Coventry. How much, you know, there is extra passion. You know, you'll have watched the football team play and the rugby union team play, you know, Scotland, England, the old enemy. And obviously, you know, at that point you talked earlier about the families as well. That must have been a big occasion. Was it trying to keep everybody on the same even keel, or did you feel that extra emotion of it being England?
100%, yeah, definitely. I think that week was just a matter of obviously recovery from the Australian game, but it was just reeling the team in a little bit. You know, they just wanted to play, wanted to get to the Ricoh Arena and play against England. You know, it was mate against mate as well. You know, Scotland and England, the rivalry between the two countries is unbelievable. And again, the build-up was probably just trying to reel the players in a little bit, you know, and try and save something for the game. And we started that game fantastically well. We identified, you know, our left-hand side, England's right hand side, you know, that there's a few things that we could maybe exploit, and we started off really well. Matty Russell scored a sensational try. Kane Lynette scored a great try, and they were straight off the training field, and we gave England a real good shock. It was just probably a sin bin for Danny Brough in the second half, and that extra little bit of quality got England through. But I was really disappointed at the end that we didn't win that game. I'll be honest, but you know, we came out of that game with a lot of credit.
Yeah, listen, we've seen in terms of try scoring in the corners, particularly with the rule that removed the corner flag, we've seen some incredible acrobatics, but I've never seen acrobatics what Matty Russell did that day. I still don't understand how he managed to ground the ball and where his body was contorted in. It was quite remarkable, wasn't it?
Yeah, Matty's been sensational for Scotland. You know, every game, you know, against the top class opposition, you know, him and you know, people like Lewis Tierney on both wings, and you know, good centres in Kane Lynette, and that try what Matty got, you'll not see better anywhere.
So obviously, yeah, you were disappointed, but you know, performances were building, and of course, it was back to Workington, a well-known stomping ground for Scotland, and success there previous. I dare say you weren't too disappointed that it was a bit wet and what we call dreek in Workington. You saw it coming up. I dare say, you know, that might have been not a bad thing from your perspective, Steve.
I must admit, 2008, when it was at Rockhampton, it was 90 degrees. You know, Tonga certainly did a job on us, and I just felt really confident. You know, when we played New Zealand, when, you know, when obviously the weather was bad and probably in our favour. I was really confident, but the build up to that game, we could hardly train. We was absolutely shot at. Danny Brough was couldn't train with his foot. Lachlan Coote couldn't train. Matty Russell couldn't train. We probably had a 20-minute pre-game session, you know, and that's probably the only prep we did leading up to that New Zealand game. A lot of video work, but we was aware that the weather would probably be on our side. You know, we've been at the back end of a few defeats when the weather's, you know, been boiling hot, i.e. the Tonga game. But the New Zealand game at Workington, where the weather wasn't great, you know, I think the gods were probably in our favour a little bit there.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously, I think got into the lead, New Zealand pulled it back, and then I think it was Kane Lynette went over for the try, or was it, no?
Who was Ewan Aiken.
Ewan Aiken went over, and it was a centre try, he went over, and of course that left, if you're going to ask anybody to kick a goal to get you into an 18-0, Danny Brough would be the man, wouldn't it, you'd ask? You put your house on it?
Yeah, and that was from the touchline, swirling wind, all the pressure, you know, on his shoulders, and it went straight through the middle. You know, there was no doubt in that, and thoroughly deserved for Danny. You know, that's probably just rewards for all the commitment he's shown, and, you know, just highlighted what a good performance that was.
Yeah, I think for me, I think one of the still great footage of Danny's reaction having kicked it, you know, and anybody who, you know, doubted in any way sort of heritage players, you know, what it meant to them, you know. And Danny had been playing at the top of the game. He didn't start, I think he was at York when he started playing for Scotland, but he was at the top of the game for much of his career. But that was really a great moment for him, for you, the team and the country, wasn't it? Just to get that 18-all draw, the first time in the Four Nations that, the fourth nation outside of Australia, New Zealand and England had not lost the match.
Yeah, that unbelievable result, Graeme. Again, disappointed we didn't win, but probably asking too much there. But just rewards for not only that year, but for the hard work, you know, all the people in the domestic game, you know, all the people who's been involved in it, and you've been involved in that yourself as well. It was just really good to do that for all the hard work that people's put in, not only, you know, for that Four Nations, but, you know, all the past. It meant an awful lot of people.
Okay. So obviously, you know, it was a busy schedule because the following year, you know, another World Cup, your second trip to Australia, a really tough group this time, wasn't it? You know, in terms of what you had to face.
It was, yeah. And you'd expect that in a World Cup. And the actual squad we had was probably the youngest I'd ever coached there. You know, a lot of inexperienced in there. A lot of high-profile key players had pulled out of the squad. Yep. So it was a little bit of a rebuilding job. You know, the first game, Tonga, in Cairns, you know, we took a proper beating in that. We then travelled over to Christchurch, and what a fantastic place that was. The way it was treated in Christchurch was unbelievable, very moving. A lot of the things we did there. And New Zealand beat us quite convincingly. Yeah. And then, you know, the last game against Samoa again was as good as I've been involved in. You know, the way that everybody pulled together against the Samoan team. And it was a drop kick away from, you know, going playing Australia in the quarterfinals up in Darwin, yeah. Which would have been fantastic.
And that brought a close to your international career. 35 matches, Steve. I don't know if you counted them, but that's what it says in Wikipedia. And it must have kind of pleased you because that, you know, obviously the Samoan, it'd been a tough pool, and you were still with a shout of qualifying, but again, people weren't giving you probably any thoughts of doing that. So again, to finish where the team yet again on paper delivered more on in the pitch than they necessarily people would look at the paper compared to the opposition. So kind of a theme running through all your coaching with Scotland was to make the team greater than the sum of their individual parts. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm really pleased the way it probably ended, because it was a tough World Cup for the players and everybody concerned with the, you know, a little bit of what had been going on. And that game, as you said, against Samoa, I look at their team as well and look at our team and some of the young players within it. And I remember just walking around. I knew it was going to be my last game for Scotland. And I remember after the game, you know, I just walked around on my own, around, you know, the ground, and just probably just reflected on my time with Scotland, and, you know, really passionate and really proud of being involved in it. And it was quite an emotional time, to be fair. But I was really pleased in the performance that, you know, that they'd left, and hopefully, you know, they can continue going forward, and I'm sure they will.
So you went into that campaign knowing it was going to be your final one. And obviously, by this point, you know, Scotland Rugby League are running everything, and the chairman, Keith Hogg, and so on. But you were adamant in your own mind that it was time to move on, which I presume was the right decision. But as you say, it must still have been hard to do because of the length and quality of the journey you'd been on.
Yeah, really tough. It was definitely the right thing to do. Give somebody else a chance and freshen everything up as well. But, you know, I even thought about my last tournament being the 2013 World Cup, but we went so well, and, you know, the players responded and everything about that. It was a tough year for myself personally. You know, with that, I lost my dad that year, and it was a real tough year. But that end of the year with Scotland was unbelievable, and just got my appetite back. And but I always knew the 2017 would be my last tournament with Scotland, and I'm just, you know, really proud and privileged to be given that opportunity initially by David Waite and everybody else that's been worth it. It's took me to fantastic places in the world, and, you know, and tournaments, and, you know, European Championships and World Cups. It's been a fantastic experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's so critical. I mean, people talk about International Rugby League and the profile it brings, absolutely, but it's also about giving, well, the players, but also staff, a chance to go on, you know, go to places, you know, in the world that you wouldn't go to if you weren't involved in that. So, you know, two trips to Australia, including a trip to New Zealand, you know, for part of the World Cup, is obviously, you know, for players is always a major calling card. But as you say, for the staff as well, you know, really life-changing opportunities.
Yeah, definitely. And I even remember, you know, the European Championships going over to Italy. You know, Italy was struggling that, but I think we stayed in Padua. Yep. And what a fantastic little town that is, you know, and, you know, going there and then going to Venice. And it's anybody that gets involved with international rugby, it's a real privilege. It's hard work, you know, it is tough, but what a great experience. And to be involved in the European tournaments and, you know, the World Cups, and to meet the people I've met, and the experiences I've had is, you know, I'll look back when I'm old and grey, you know, when I got my slippers on, and think, wow, what an unbelievable few years I had.
And just one rumour that's always gone round, Steve, obviously the team stayed in Inverclyde a lot, and Inverclyde's a great centre of high performance, but it's a little bit out of the way. You know, is there any truth in the rumour that there's a fantastic pie shop in well, what's Largs, which is actually where Inverclyde is? You know, obviously being a Wiganer, you know, I don't want to cast any sort of, you know, sweeping generalisations, but is that true why it was picked as location?
There's some vicious rumours going around, Graham, that there is a 24-hour pie shop, and that's true. That's true, to be honest. It takes some finding. You know, it's not something that's advertised, and it's not got loads of banners around, but we found it. And there's a few Wiganers within the team as well. So, you know, even though, you know, Inverclyde was brilliant, probably one of the coldest places I've ever been, we always decided to go up there, and, you know, that was always a welcome boost, that pie shop.
what a good part to end on there. Thank you, Steve. Thanks for sharing that journey. You know, we've had Tyrone on McCarthy and his 11-year ongoing journey from a player point of view. To have yours as coaching is another insight. And yeah, you know, you must be one of, if not the longest serving, you know, at 14 seasons and 35 matches. So many congratulations on what you achieved for yourself as a coach, on the staff you work with, and of course, for Scotland and those players. And thanks for sharing that just now, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Graham, and thanks for all your help as well. You know, you've been a big help during those years as well. It's much appreciated.
Thank you. Appreciate you saying that. Listen, folks, that's the end of this podcast. As ever, we're seeing more and more rugby league, hopefully coming out and being played. Return of Super League, you know, the NRL in full swing, and of course across Europe, you know, some playing arrive in the Czech and Serbia. Hopefully, Poland also starting to play some domestic rugby league soon. So, we hope that you're still safe and healthy during this COVID time, and we look forward to you joining us again in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you.